Hey everyone, this is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems and BikeJames.com, and welcome to another Bike James podcast. Got some good stuff on tap for us today. Going to be talking about grip strength training for mountain biking. Going to be talking about the attack position and why it's something that you want to avoid. You don't want to spend a whole lot of time there. And also, I want to share the results of a study. It's one that I've come across a while ago. I've referenced it a few times when talking about why isometric training is so valuable for us as mountain bikers, but I wanted to share the study and what those results were and just kind of explain a little bit more in depth why isometric training is so important for you to have in your program. So before I do that though, I want to remind you to go to bikejames.com, and if you haven't done so already, sign up for the free newsletter. I'll send you a free workout, send out free weekly training tips. Man, I cover all sorts of stuff, really. So when you go to the website and check out the blog and the things that I've posted, you'll find not only training and riding stuff, but you're going to find things on nutrition, things on mindset, the things that really support the lifestyle habits that support your training and riding. Because if you want to be a better rider, it's really a lifestyle that you have to adopt. You can't just plug and play certain things like, oh, I'm going to do this training program, or I'm going to follow this skills training thing, and then not pay attention to the lifestyle habits really that support your efforts in those areas. So that's why I talk about and I cover those things on my blog, because like I said, those things are important. But to go to bikejames.com and you can find that stuff. Got all sorts of free workouts you can check out, and just it's a wealth of information for you as a mountain biker. I mean, the whole reason I started MTB Strength Training Systems and BikeJames.com in the first place is because back in 2005, when I was getting into mountain biking, I was trying to, figure out like what the heck, how do I get better? And there weren't any really good resources for doing that. And so I created the website because it was something that I wish that I had when I had first started riding. And so, like I said, I think it's a good resource. Obviously, I'm a little biased with that. But like I said, if you haven't gone to bikejames.com and signed up for the newsletter, make sure that you do that. Also, want to remind you about pedalinginnovations.com. To go check that out. That's where you'll find the Catalyst pedal. That is the pedal that I created. It is based on the actual science and movement principles behind the pedal stroke and how the leg optimally creates movement in the context of pedaling and moving on your bike, right? Because it's very important. Like, athleticism is contextual. Like, what it takes to be athletic in a pool, right, doing swimming or water polo or something like that, is going to be different than what it takes to be athletic on a mountain bike, okay? And so the context of athleticism and the demands of the body is very important. You have to look at what are these contexts so that we understand how to train them better. And when you look at the context of your foot on the bike, you see that it is not coming off the pedal. Okay. I mean, obviously if you're doing a trick or something, you're trying to do it purposefully, that's one thing, but you, unless you're doing it on purpose, you don't want your foot to come off the pedal. So the vast majority of the time, your foot is going to stay planted on the pedal, which means that it does not come off of the surface that it is in contact with. And so this is a different context than if it does. Okay. So if you're running or jumping or, something that requires you to actually your foot to come off of what it's in contact with, that's a different context than what you're doing on the bike. And so the big mistake that people have made for a long time is misunderstanding the context of the foot. They look at sports and activities that have a different context. So they'll look at soccer or Olympic lifting or, just some other example, and inevitably these sports all require the foot to break contact with the ground. But when you look at sports and activities where the foot stays in contact with the ground or what it's on, you see that the foot's going to behave differently. So when you look at sports like surfing or skateboarding or skiing, if you look at lifting in the gym, right, then you'll see that you want your foot to have support and pressure through both ends of the arch. And it's those double pressure points that allow the foot to act to work optimally, recruit the hips, keep the stress where you want it. And so that's why I designed the Catalyst pedal, to bridge the gap between the front and back of the arch so that you can get pressure at the ball of the foot and at the back of the arch, towards the heel. And so it's not about one or the other. It's about being able to do both. And again, if you look at the context of the foot on the bike. And then you compare it to the ways that we move in similar contexts. You see that the movement principles are different than what we're told. And so again, that's kind of the rationale behind the Catalyst pedal. But yeah, you go there, check it out. I've got the science behind it posted there. You know, some more explanations of how it works. But in a nutshell, that's what it is. It creates the correct context for your foot so that it can function as efficiently as possible. And so it's going to let you pedal with more power. It's going to take stress off of the calf and Achilles tendon and ankles and knees and low back. So it's really a great experience for your foot. And if you know the importance of the foot for how the rest of the body is supposed to function, then you understand why that is so important. And if you don't, then it's very important, right? If your foot doesn't function well, then the rest of your body is going to suffer. And so that's, in a nutshell, that's what it's about. So make sure that your foot has the right support. Go check out pedalinginnovations.com and learn more about the Catalyst pedal. All right, so on to today's subjects. The first one is grip strength training. And this is a rider Q&A that I got from someone who was asking, do I do grip strength training? And if so, what do I do? And this is a great question because grip strength is extremely important for you as a mountain biker. And in fact, there's a study that you can go to bikechange.com. The article I wrote is The Science of Going Downhill Faster. But they did a study and looked at downhill racing and looked at what was the factor that was most closely related to your performance. And they found that grip strength endurance and your skills, like those were the top two things. But grip strength endurance, like that was kind of this interesting thing when you think about it, it makes sense. And so any time that your bike is pointed down and you're going downhill, your grip strength endurance is one of the major factors for how well you're going to do, right? They looked at cardio fitness like VO2 max and all that stuff. That stuff did not correlate to that. And so it was the grip strength endurance that correlated to that. So your grip strength endurance and your grip strength are obviously related, right? Because it's grip strength endurance. And so it can get a little confusing though for what is the best way to train it as a mountain biker, because you don't just want grip strength, you want the grip strength endurance and the grip strength that you have on the bike. Again, I was just talking about it with the rationale behind the Catalyst pedal. You know, what is the context for the grip strength that we need on the bike? And then how do we best train that? And some of the common ways that we think about training the grip for mountain biking is actually doesn't have a whole lot of carryover for us when we look at the context for what we need on the bike versus the context of what they're doing for us. And so, like I said, it's a good question. First and foremost, most of your grip strength training and most of my grip strength training comes from riding my bike. Like doing your sport is the best sport-specific training you can do. So riding your bike is going to be the best grip strength training you can do, the best grip strength training, endurance training you can do. It's the most specific training you can do. So riding your bike is it should be the foundation for your grip training. And sometimes people forget about this, right? People do this a lot with cardio training, for example. They forget that when you're riding your bike, that is cardio training. That is the most specific cardio training you can do. And not recognizing that and then having another cardio training program can actually start to cause problems because you realize that, wow, I'm really doing a lot of cardio. I'm riding my bike and doing this specific cardio training, and I'm actually overloading my cardio system and making it harder for it to recover and for me to actually get better and see results. And the same thing can happen with your grip strength training, right? If you don't recognize that riding your bike is grip strength training, and then someone tells you on a podcast that grip strength endurance is important for your performance, and then you just start doing a bunch of grip strength training on top of that, you may be overtraining your grip and making it harder for it to recover and improve. Because remember, training breaks you down. It's how well do you recover from that training that's going to dictate the results that you get. So too much training makes it harder for your body to recover. So keep in mind that your riding is grip strength training. And also, your normal strength training should involve grip strength training. And so doing deadlifts, doing chin-ups, doing rows, doing things that challenge the grip, that is, again, grip strength training. So if you look at someone who's riding 3-4 times a week and doing 2-3 days of strength training, they're probably getting all the grip training that they need for the most part, okay? So there are two exceptions to this though. Now, if I'm riding less than 2 times a week, then I will add in some specific grip strength work on top of my regular strength training. And I will also prescribe grip specific work to someone if they need to quickly improve that area. Okay, so if somebody comes to me and they're like, man, their grip strength is just really bad, especially in the context of how they need it on the bike, then using some of the things that I'm going to talk about to quickly improve the grip strength is going to help them get to the point where riding their bike can start to be the type of grip strength training that they need, and they can start to rely on that more. But sometimes you do need to do a little grip specific work just to get the grip to a decent point, because it's hard to, you know, on the bike you are using what you've got. It's really hard to build more, right? And so like if your grip strength is really bad, then you're going to develop a way of holding yourself on the bike that allows you to compensate for that bad grip strength. And then trying to just use riding to build grip strength, a lot of times you're just going to build that dysfunction. You're just going to strengthen that dysfunction. So making sure that you have just the requisite level of grip strength to be able to hold yourself properly on the bike, like I said, it's a requisite for being able to start riding your bike and using your bike as training, as opposed to just kind of surviving and inflicting dysfunctions on your body. And so this is one of the reasons that you have to train. You have to have a requisite level of strength and mobility in order to ride efficiently and properly. Otherwise, your body is just creating compensations that may not necessarily be, you know, a big deal now, but on a long enough timeline, they will add up. You will hit, you know, points where you can't continue to improve, and overuse injuries will start to add up. And so, you know, grip strength is one of these areas that this is an example of. And so this is one of these things. I know some people don't like to hear it because on some level they take it as me saying you're not good enough the way that you are. And oh God, how dare you say that? But yeah, you're not good enough the way that you are. I mean, I have this conversation with myself, and you have to have a tough conversation with yourself sometimes and realize like, man, I do have things that I need to work on, and I need to work on them rather than make excuses and try to get the world to conform to the way that I see things, sort of thing. Anyways, kind of a little side tangent there. But the point is you need to do some grip strength specific work if your grip strength really just sucks right off the bat. Otherwise, you can use your riding and regular strength training more. So what is the context for grip strength? I talked about that. You know, we need to think about the context for grip strength. So the context for grip strength on the bike, if you think about it, you got two things going on. One is the grip strength that you're using. It's not a constant grip strength. It's not a static level of grip strength. There's times when you want your grip to be loose, and then there's times when you want your grip to be tight. Okay, that you definitely need to grip your bars tight to keep them from getting ripped out of your hands from time to time, or when you're loading up to do a bunny hop or a manual or something like that. Like there is time when you're going to put weight and pressure on your hands, or the bars are going to try to get ripped out of your hands, and so you're going to have to increase the grip in that moment to compensate for that. But you don't want that death grip, right? Like we know we don't want the death grip because it makes it harder to maneuver and steer our bike. And it also is metabolically very inefficient. You're going to be burning a lot of energy, and your grip just isn't going to last as long as it will if you're able to relax and use just what you need when you need it. And so you need the ability to turn the tension on and off quickly. That is the context for it. So something that just trains a static load. So for example, farmer's walks. Like I love farmer's walks, and I do them, but I don't do them for the grip strength work, like not from a mountain biking standpoint. Like they train an aspect of my grip that I want to work on, but they're not a very mountain bike specific way to train your grip. And one of the problems is that it's just the static constant load. And so it's not challenging your grip in the same way as how you want to use your grip on the bike. Now, the other thing, that's another reason that farmer's walks kind of fall short as a mountain bike specific grip training exercise, and that is that you need your wrists to stabilize in all four directions. And people just have chronically weak wrists. It's just not something that we train very often. And so we don't do a lot of manual labor with our hands. And so our hands and our wrists tend to be very weak. And your wrists are having to stabilize in really every direction. Okay, it's not just front and back, right? Like if you flap your hands up and down, then, not only in that direction, but also like if you hold your hands level and then try to move them from side to side, right? Like you're mixing DJ mixing the record there. Like that side to side movement, that lateral movement. So you need front and back and lateral stability in your wrists. And that lateral stability especially is something that we don't train much of, and most people are severely lacking it. Like this is one of the reasons that picking up a sledgehammer for people that don't pick up sledgehammers a lot feels super heavy, because sledgehammers challenge that lateral grip strength. And it's something that most people have never really had challenged before. And so this is one of the reasons that people have so many problems with their wrists on the bike, is because they have weak, unstable wrists. And so, using the little winged grips to try to compensate for how you'll cock your wrist to try to make up for that, and then using the little winged ergo grips to make up for that, that is not fixing the problem. That is just leaning even harder into the dysfunction that you're creating. This is, if you use those things and you say, I need those things, then I would argue that you probably don't have the requisite strength or wrist stability to be able to move properly on the bike in the first place. And that's what you need to be working on and fixing, not worrying about, this other stuff. And so but you need that stability in all four directions there. And so again, if you think about something like a farmer's walk, it's not challenging wrist stability in at all for the most part. It is just challenging your ability to hang on to something. So the grip has several different functions. There was actually a book I read a while back called Mastery of Hand Strength. I forget who wrote it, but it was one of the first books that really opened my eyes to the fact, like, oh yeah, the hand and the grip, like when you say grip strength, what do you mean? Like, what are you trying to do with your grip? And so now we can talk about how to get it stronger, because the grip does so many different things. Your hand does so many different things. And so you training the hand and the wrists to perform these tasks, like all of these things are grip training. And so just having a couple, things like the, what's another one that people like to do? Like the stick, right, that has the string in the middle, and you tie a weight to it, and you roll the weight up and down, right, the little wrist burner things. That's not great, because you're creating movement. You're not wanting to train your wrist to move. You're wanting to train the static, more isometric strength of the wrist. And so that's a different context. And, so a lot of the things that people think of when, how do I train my grip strength, usually involve like holding heavy weights in some way for time, usually that and the, what was the other thing I was just talking about? The, I forgot. But anyways, so, the wrist roller things, right? So something that is using movement. So you're doing like wrist curls or something that uses movement in the wrist. And neither one of those are the same context for what you need on the bike, right? Like that's not training the ability to change pressure and tension in the wrist on demand, and it's not training wrist stability. It's training wrist movement. And so, these things are not actually they are training an element of your grip, which you could argue I want to train anyways. That's fine. But if we're trying to train mountain bike specific grip strength and grip strength endurance, then we have to use the same context as what we're using on the bike, or it's not really going to carry over. So what this means is that the two exercises that I use for this are swings and the mace 360s and 10 and 2s, where the mace is swinging around the head. The 360s is where it's just going in one direction, and the 10 and 2s is where it's like alternating, going one direction then the other. And so those two exercises are by far the best ones for training this element of grip strength, and specifically grip strength endurance, that we need on the bike. So if you're doing swings, Swing can be either with kettlebells or dumbbells. Remember, you can do swings with dumbbells, and you can actually have your feet in a narrow, more mountain bike specific position using dumbbells than you can with kettlebells. But either way, the swing has that element, because at the top and the bottom, where you're having to hold the weight and you're changing direction, you're having to increase your grip strength. And then as it's traveling through the arc, you're relaxing the grip, and then you grip tighter at the end and you're changing direction, and then you relax it. So you're training that on and off element that you need on the bike. And the Mace 360s and 10 and 2s are by far the best, most specific grip strength training you can do as a mountain biker. Like, they train your, not only that element of the on and off, because as you're doing the 360s, you can't just keep the same grip. You have to loosen your grip as it's traveling, and then tighten the grip as it hits the bottom and you're trying to pull it out of the back, and then loosen and tighten. So there's the loosening and tightening element of the grip. And it's also working the wrist stability, especially that lateral wrist stability that we just don't get trained much at all. In fact, I don't really know of anything that trains the lateral wrist stability like the Maces and the heavy Indian clubs as well. But these leverage-based training tools that I talk about, that's one of the reasons that I like them so much, because one of the things that is required to handle a leverage-based training tool is good lateral wrist stability. And so you're getting that, both those elements, with the Mace 360s and the 10 and 2. So again, another reason I'm such a big fan of using the Mace is because of that leverage element and how it trains the grip in a more specific way than just about any other tool for what we're doing on the bike. And so, but either way, kettlebells or dumbbell swings, Mace 360s or 10 and 2s, but those are going to be your best ways to train your grip for the specific demands of mountain biking. And, you know, there are some other things. I mean, you know, with the Mace especially, because that lateral wrist stability, like, that's a tough one. I mean, really, just holding a Mace. I mean, a lot of times I don't start people out with 360s. Like, I will say that, like, you're not going to grab a Mace and just start doing 360s. You're going to grab a Mace and you're going to learn how to hold it. You're going to learn how to handle it. You're going to learn how to do a pullover. You're going to learn how to do a few basic things and spend a little time with that Mace before you start doing the 360s and the 10 and 2s. And that learning process is going to build that lateral wrist stability that you need in order to be doing the 360s effectively. And so there is kind of that process. If you're doing it properly, you're going to go through that process. So you'll build the strength before you start really working on like that endurance element, which the 360s are going to add into it. And so, just something to keep in mind. So grip strength is super important. Grip strength, endurance is super important. Concentrate on your bike rides and training. And then using swings and Mace 360s and 10 and 2s and some of the supporting exercises for those movements to help train the grip if you need to focus on it a little bit more specifically. So the next thing that I'm going to talk about is the attack position. So the attack position has a few names, but it's essentially your low position on the bike. This is where you've got your butt back and your chest is down, you know, kind of like you're trying to be really aerodynamic looking. And it's looks like the bottom of a deadlift or a hip hinge. It's basically the bottom of a hip hinge is what your attack position is. So this low position, this low attack position, it has its uses, but there is a trend in riding and in skills coaching circles to try to find the single position, the single best position that you're supposed to move from. And so you find this position and then you move. Everything you do is moving from that position. And the problem with that is that one of the positions that gets proposed as, well, where do you want to be moving from, is this attack position. And so it has people spending way too much time in it. And this position, while it has its place, has some negative effects. I guess, you know, it's a trade-off, right? And so there are some things to consider. It's not all, when you get down in that position, what is exactly happening? and how does that affect the rest of the bike? And is that what you actually want with as much time as you're spending in that position? So as you get down into this low attack position, your weight is naturally going to shift back, especially if you're doing it right. Okay, if you don't have a good hip hinge and you're tipping forward and you feel like you're putting more weight on your hands and your weight's going forward, well, you're not doing a good hip hinge. If you're doing a good hip hinge, your weight is going to slide back ever so slightly because you are shifting your center of gravity behind your base. Okay, your feet are your base. And your center of gravity is going, which is, you know, roughly around your hips. It's, you know, a little bit below your navel, but it's, you know, your hips are one of the major influencers of where it's at. Okay, so where your hips are at is going to dictate where your center of gravity is going to be. And so as your hips are sliding back, it's moving your center of gravity back as well. And so this is going to bias your weight back. And so, like, this is good in some spots, right? If you need to take weight off the front end, then that's great. So if you are in a position where you might go over the handlebars, and so, you know, if you're going like a downhill or you need to really shift your weight back because, you know, you're going to take an impact that you didn't quite expect or whatever, you're rolling off a ledge that's really tall and you need to really get your weight far back, like these are all positions or instances where getting your weight back and unweighting your front end is good. But the problem is that you need weight on the front end of the bike to steer, and a lot of skills require a weight shift from front to back to initiate. And so if your weight's already shifted back, then that means you've got to shift your weight forward and then back again, or you're shifting from kind of back to like more back, which isn't the same thing as having your weight in the front and then shifting back. And so, you know, really having your weight biased back, the trade-off, the benefit is it's hard to go over your handlebars because you have your weight off the front end. But the trade-off is that it's going to be harder to maintain traction in a corner, right? Because you need weight and pressure on your front end in order to have traction. If you don't have weight on your front end, there's no way to apply pressure through your hands into the front tire, and that makes it very difficult to maintain traction. And so you have to have some weight there. It's also going to make it tough to initiate skills like manuals, bunny hops, drops, and jumps. All of those skills are initiated by a weight shift from front to back. It's having your weight in the front, right? Like the way that I think about it, that your bike has a center of gravity as well. It's roughly your bike's bottom bracket. Okay, I know it's not exactly there, but much like the hips, the bottom bracket is very close to it and a good just kind of visual for most people. And so I split the bike in half, okay? It's where is my weight? If the weight is in front, you know, towards the front end of that, of the bike, then I call that the front of the cockpit. And then if it's behind the bottom bracket towards the back, I call that the back of the cockpit. Okay, and so a skill like a manual, for example, you're doing a weight shift. You have to have your weight in the front of the cockpit. You have to have your weight in front, and then you shift your weight to the back of the cockpit. And as you shift your weight back, that is what creates the movement that results in the front wheel getting light and lifting up off the ground. Obviously, you got to do some you know, technique along with that weight shift in order to make it really work. But at its core, it's that weight shift that is creating the manual. That a manual, your weight shifts from front to back, getting the front wheel up, and then shifting your weight back front again to lift up the rear wheel. That's a bunny hop. Coming up to a ledge and then pushing the bike in front of you and shifting the weight back and then following the bike off. That's how you do a drop. When you're going into a jump, you want to have your weight forward. And as you hit the jump, you, especially if you're trying to pop off the lip, you are driving the bike into the lip. And so you are essentially shifting your weight from front to back to a more back position. And so if you have your weight back, okay, if you're in this low attack position and all of a sudden you need to do a manual, like I said, you have one of two choices. You can either try to shift your weight forward and then back again, which is going to take an extra, you know, second or half second. And, you know, on a trail, a half second can mean the difference between cleaning something and a bad wreck. Okay. Or the other thing, and this is what a lot of riders do, is they don't really shift their weight from front to back. They shift their weight from kind of back to more back. And that's that, you know, that's kind of a manual that will kind of get the front wheel to get light, but it's not the same thing as having your weight forward and shifting it back. So this is why, you know, again, it's a trade-off. So the attack position, this low position, it's good for keeping you from going over the handlebars. But unless you are in imminent danger of going over the handlebars, then it isn't needed, and it actually makes it harder to move on and steer your bike. Right? I mean, this is just your – so what you want is to have a taller, more forward kind of quote-unquote neutral position, right? It's this, well, where is my neutral position? And then the idea is not to stay in this neutral position, right? Like the neutral position that I, you know, advise is a taller – this is one of the reasons I like standing pedaling, right? I guess you have to stand to get in the attack position. But this is a way more comfortable position to hold than trying to hold that low attack position all the time. But it's a more upright, more forward posture. And I have a little bit of weight on the hands, and my weight is biased a little bit to the front end of the bike. It's really similar to running. Like if you think about riding your bike, it is similar to running. And running is a controlled fall. Like you're like Bruce Lee, I once read, he described running as chasing your center of gravity and never quite catching it. Right? Like your center of gravity is just out in front of you and you're chasing it, but you're not quite catching up to it. That's running. It is an unbalanced position and you are running. Right? That's why you would fall. If your foot catches something, you fall because it's an unbalanced position. Well, what happens for a lot of riders is they've had a fall. They've tripped over something and fell. And then the reaction, and then it's, you know, backed up by advice from skills coaches and the industry to stay in this position, is to shift the weight back. So, you know, if you've ever gone trail running, and you've tripped on a rock, like, you know, you got to watch your feet. And if you mess up, you can trip. The answer is not to lean backwards as you run. Okay, if I lean backwards as I run, am I going to trip and fall? No, I'm not going to trip and fall. Now, and when I'm running down or, you know, and I'm afraid of catching something and tripping and falling, I'm going to lean back a little bit for that exact reason. Okay, because I'm biasing my weight into a position that makes it harder for me to trip and fall forward by having my weight back a little bit. But if I ran like that all the time, it'd be a super inefficient position to run from. And it's silly, right? Like you're not always going to trip over something. So there's no reason to not shift your weight forward and then learn how to watch your feet and shift your weight as needed instead of just pick this one position, this kind of backward safe position, and just live there. And that's kind of what has happened with, again, what happens with a lot of riders is that attack position feels safe because you have your weight shifted back. So it does make it harder for you to go over the handlebars. But you're not in imminent danger of going over the handlebars all the time. In fact, the vast majority of the time, you're not. And you can see when something's coming up. All right. So you getting into a taller, more forward position allows you to steer better. And then when you do need to execute a skill because you see something coming up ahead of you, it's easier for you to initiate it and execute it because you're able to shift your weight from front to back because your weight is already a little forward. So, you know, shifting your weight down and back into that low attack position as needed certainly has a place. But you don't want to live there. That is not your neutral position because you're just not going to be able to move very well from there. So The main thing is, like, don't be afraid to have some purposeful pressure and weight on your hands. This whole idea of light hands, heavy feet, this is another reason people like the attack position, because they hear this advice. And so when you get into that low attack position, it makes it easier for you to lean back a little bit and unweight your hands. And so you feel like, man, I've really got light hands in this position. When you get into a taller position, you put weight on your hands. Well, you know, if you're being told that any weight on your hands is the devil, then you don't want to do that. And so this misunderstanding of the difference between weight and pressure, you need weight to apply pressure through the front end, but they're not the same thing. So having just dead weight on the front end isn't what you want. having enough weight to be able to apply pressure is what you want. So you don't be afraid of putting some weight and pressure on the front end. And I guarantee you, you're going to find that you can steer and move way more effectively on your bike than if you're, you know, avoiding that front of the cockpit position and always kind of hanging out in this, you know, back of the cockpit attack position spot. Because again, you just, it feels safe. You've been told this is where you want to be to initiate your skills. And you know, it's a, yeah, you're able to keep weight off your hands. And again, you're thinking like, hey, I got to keep weight off my hands. So you're able to check all these boxes, feel safe, you know, conforms to what the industry is telling me to do. And I'm also able to keep my weight off my hands, which is, again, what they're telling me to do. So it's checking all these boxes. So I understand why people like it and think that it's what you want to do. But it's not. Like I said, if you really step back and think about it, you are taking away from your ability to do pretty much everything else on your bike. Anything else you want to do on your bike is going to require some weight and pressure on the front end. And so having it biased to the back all the time is just going to make it harder for you to do those things. So anyways, that's why you want to avoid that attack position and get better at that, you know, kind of standing more tall position and moving around on the bike. It's really about weight shifts. It's your weight shifts from front to back and side to side and creating a wedge with your body between your handlebars and your hands. Like, this is what drives your bike. Okay, it's not this like static thing where you're just in this one position and it's like, you know, drop your outside foot and extend your inside arm. That's not it. That's not riding your bike, okay? That is trying to check boxes and look like you're riding your bike. But riding your bike is way more about feel and movement and weight shifts and pressure and understanding like how these things affect what your bike is going to do and then manipulating those things purposefully to get it to do what you want to do. So anyways, moving on. So next one, last thing that I got on to talk about is the bro science. And again, this is where I find a study and then break it down for you as far as like what I think it means for us as mountain bikers. So again, this is a study I said before I referenced a few times when I talk about the benefits of isometric training for mountain bikers. And isometric training, just in case you don't know, isometric means without movement. So you are creating tension without moving. So you're either pushing into something that won't move or you are pulling on something that won't move. But, you know, either way, you are creating tension in the body without creating movement. And so isometric training has a super long history. I mean, people have been doing isometric training for as long as there's been physical culture. Like the original yoga, a huge aspect of yoga is isometric holds. You're getting in these postures and you're holding them for time. That is isometric training. And again, when you look back at like the original yoga, the real yoga, they had a small handful of postures that they would hold for very long periods of time. So it was an extreme form of isometric training. You look at the world of martial arts, things like horse stance, you know, that traditional kind of karate, you know, stance where people would get in and hold that, you know, kind of a low squat with the legs wide position. You know, they would hold loaded pots out to the side. You know, we've all seen these pictures of, you know, Shaolin monks and martial arts masters holding these positions. So that is isometric training. The Greeks, when I was doing research into this, they would hold heavy metal plates in front of them for time. Again, isometric training. Spartan archers would draw their bows and hold for time. So when you look back through the history of humans, we have been using isometric training for a long, 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 long time. And there's actually a lot of science behind it as well. But it just gets kind of dismissed a little bit. I've talked about why a few times as well. I mean, one of the reasons is the bodybuilding culture that took over the fitness scene for quite a while. Isometrics are great at a lot of things. They're not great at building a lot of muscle. So, you know, for us, you know, trying to build strength without muscle, that's great. But if you're a bodybuilder, that's not so great. So do you think that's going to be a technique that you really, you know, throw out there or that you really pursue and is talked about a lot? You know, no. So it gets forgotten about. It's more difficult, I guess. Like, some people don't really understand how to use it. And so it just kind of gets dismissed. But it's a lot like the kettlebell. Okay, the kettlebell had a long storied history of being used as a training tool, and for various reasons just got forgotten about for a while, and then got rediscovered around, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, and repopularized. And I think isometrics kind of fall in that same category of something that when you look at it and you're like, man, why are we not doing this more? This used to be such a huge part of strength training, and the research behind it is pretty fascinating. Like, why are we not doing this more? And I, like I said, I think like the kettlebell, eventually isometrics are going to come back around, and we're going to be like, man, why do we let these go for so long? But I wanted to share one of the studies that I've talked about. And this one is, the title of it is Effects of Isometric Strength Training on Mechanical, Electrical, and Metabolic Aspects of Muscle Function. And so in this study, what they did is they took six sets of twins. So they had, I think it was four male and two female. And they had one set of twins doing isometric knee extension training. So basically doing like a knee extension hold and on the right leg. And then the other set of twins weren't doing anything. So you had, you know, one group doing isometric training, one group as a control group that wasn't doing isometric training. So the obvious thing that they found was that doing this increased isometric strength, and in the group that trained, and the group that didn't train didn't show any results. I mean, that's not really a surprise. But what the specific results that they found in the group that did the training were really interesting. Several things were really, really interesting. So first, the isometric training group showed a 20% increase in isometric strength in the right leg. I mean, that's to be expected. You know, it was a 12-week study. So 20% is pretty significant, but you would expect that, right? They train the right leg, it's going to get stronger. They also saw an 11% increase in strength in the left leg. They didn't train the left leg, but they still saw an 11% increase in strength in the left leg, in the isometric strength, which, again, that's super cool to me. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but it has a lot of things, right? Like just if you're dealing with an injury, like doing isometric training, we know this to some degree that doing strength training has a carryover effect to the non-injured side. But isometric training helps increase that isometric strength, which is super important for stability. And a lot of those things that you're looking for an injured limb to try to regain before you start doing a lot of movement with it. And so, but yeah, that was interesting. You also saw increased EMG activity in the rectus femoris. So that's your main muscle there in the quad, the big fat middle one. So increased activity, saw more muscle fibers being used in it. There was a decrease in the IMG tension ratio at submax levels. And so what this meant is that there was a more economical use of the rectus femoris, that this decrease in the activity to tension ratio meant that it was creating tension with less activity, the same level of tension with less activity, which means that it was being more efficient with how it was creating that tension. So again, that's super impressive. Okay. Muscle biopsies that they did, it showed an increase in the enzymes responsible for aerobic metabolism. Okay. The things that help your muscles utilize the oxygen that you take in, the enzymes that it needs to do that, were increased by doing this isometric training. Now, the conclusion that they came to was that along with the increased strength, you saw an increased recruitment of available motor units, the available motor unit recruitment pool, which is that's one of the things that we talk about. This is why it's important to do strength training as a rider. Because yes, you have these muscle fibers, but you don't always have access to all of them. You have to train in a way that gives you access. You see increased recruitment of the pool. You have this pool of muscle fibers available for use. And unless you do something to get some of them online, you're not going to have access to them when you're doing your cardio activity. So when you're on the bike, and if you don't do strength training, you're not going to have access to the same number of muscle fibers to help power the work as you will if you do. And that's what this is, you know, pointing out, is that you see this increased recruitment of the available motor unit pool. You see improved efficiency at sub-maximum loads, and you see an enhancement of oxidative metabolism in the muscle. This is, you know, pretty much a quote from the study for what they found. Actually, I think they said it was surprisingly also an enhancement. Like, they were surprised to find that isometric training increased oxidative metabolism in the muscle. So taken together, if this was a cardio training technique, results like this would be a big deal. Okay, if they said, hey, if you do this cardio training technique and you're going to be able to recruit more muscle fibers, you're going to improve your efficiency at sub-maximum loads, and you're going to increase and enhance your oxidative metabolism, your ability to utilize oxygen in the muscles, you're going to have access to more muscle fibers, you're going to use the muscle fibers that you have more efficiently, and you're going to increase their ability to use oxygen. That's a big deal, right? But the problem is that isometric training is pigeonholed as a strength training thing. It's a strength training technique. And so these results are largely ignored for what they mean for us when it comes to cardio training and the endurance side of things. And one of the things that you got to keep in mind is that your cardio system, you can only increase the size of your cardio system so much. Eventually, it becomes a matter of how efficiently you can use that cardio system. So if you think about it like a car, you can't increase the size of your gas tank indefinitely. You're going to reach a maximum size. This is why nobody's VO2 max just continues to increase forever. It reaches an upper limit. But so at that point, it becomes how efficiently, you know, how many miles per gallon can you get out of your gas tank? And so that efficiency side of things is the most important thing. It's not the size of the gas tank. That is important, but the most important thing is how many miles per gallon. This efficiency side of things is the most important thing when it comes to your endurance on the bike. And so we, you know, the isometric training gets dismissed, but when you look at the results that it has, you see that it's this weird thing. Yes, it improves strength, but it also improves your cardio. It improves your cardio in a very specific way to what we need as mountain bikers. And because the nature of isometric training means that you are under constant tension for long periods of time, it's high tension cardio, which is another thing that we need on the bike. Like, this is, you know, I think what's happening there is that constant tension in the cardio system having to power the muscle, creating energy through this constant tension. Like, that's why the muscles get more efficient at using oxygen, because they're in this high tension situation for extended periods of time. And this is very specific to what we need on the bike as well. So isometric training improves your strength and your cardio in ways that nothing else can. And this is one of the reasons that I use them and recommend them to every rider. I have the Atomic Strength Training Program, which is an isometric training program based on my research and experiments with different methods over the last couple years, but I can't really emphasize it enough. Like I said, if I was to read those results off to you and then tell you, man, yeah, you got to do these intervals, and they're going to give you, you know, you're going to get increased motor recruitment, increased efficiency, and be able to use oxygen better in those muscles, people would be all over them. But as soon as I tell them it's isometric training, the glazed look comes over, and it's like, oh, okay, I know about isometrics. Yeah, whatever. You know, whatever. They're good, but there's better things. We need to be focusing on other things because they're just, you know, not as good as these other things, which is just not true. They build strength super efficiently and in a safe way. They build cardio super efficiently and in a safe way. And so if you're not using isometrics as a part of your training program, you are missing out on a big kind of a low-hanging fruit. They're very easy to use, and it's really no reason to not be using them. But anyway, so there you go. Just wanted to share that study and what those results actually were, and, you know, maybe give you a little more insight into, like, why I'm so excited when I talk about isometrics. Because as you dig into it and you see what these studies say and what the results of isometrics actually are, and you experience it and you see it with other people, you start to realize, like, man, we have really been screwing up by not focusing on this stuff more and by focusing way too much on movement-based training and not enough on isometric-based training. So, yeah, go check out more at bikejames.com. Just type in isometrics in the search function there, and I'm sure you'll find plenty of other info on that. I've even got a podcast on isometrics. I think how, you know, not moving can help you ride faster, I think was the title of it or something like that. But anyways, I got a lot more info there if you're interested in more specifics about isometrics and the techniques that I use and how I do it. And yeah, so go check that out. So that's going to do it for this podcast. Hope you guys enjoyed it. As always, I had fun doing it. Remember to go to bikejames.com, sign up for the newsletter if you haven't. Check out all the great free stuff I got for you there. Go to pedalinginnovations.com and check out the Catalyst pedal. Get you a pair if you don't have one already. Your feet will thank you, and your riding will improve, and your aches and pains will go away, and your, you know, skin will clear up, and the opposite sex will find you more attractive, or the same, depending upon what you're into. But anyways, those last two few ones, obviously I'm choking there. But sometimes when I'm explaining what the results are, I mean, man, both from isometrics and the Catalyst pedal, sometimes I feel like an infomercial salesman, right? Like isometrics, I'm like, you know, 2 20-minute workouts a week and you can increase your strength and cardio. That sounds fucking ridiculous. You know, put these pedals on your bike and, you know, ride faster, have more fun, and have your aches and pains go away. It sounds stupid. It sounds ridiculous. Like somebody's making some stuff up. But, you know, unfortunately, that is the results from both of those things, right? Isometrics really do deliver results like that. And the Catalyst pedals really do deliver results like that too. So, you know, make sure you're using both of them to your advantage. So anyways, that's going to do it. I will talk to everybody next time.